Hello and welcome to Woman with Balls, where I, Katie Balls, speak to today's trailblazers. My guest today was born in Seascale in Cumbria. The granddaughter of a miner and a farmer, she attended Wyndham School before spending 5 years at Sellafield, a nuclear power company. She went on to work at Copeland Council for another six, while completing a foundation degree at Salford University, before being selected to run as a Conservative candidate in the 2017 Copeland by-election. It was the first win for a governing party in a by-election since 1982. As the first time Copeland had elected a Conservative MP since 1931, it was also seen as a major blow for Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party. On arrival in Parliament, the Times sketch writer Patrick Kidd described her debut speaking in the Commons as a maiden speech, swan-like in its grace and beauty. In it, she thanked her daughters. Having four daughters aged 14, 15, 17 and 18, I was delighted to tip the balance of female MPs to 456, equaling the balance between all of history's women members and the current number of male members, she said. Since becoming an MP, she has introduced a 10-minute rule bill to ban wild animals and circuses, sat on the Education Committee and served as a parliamentary private secretary for several departments. In December 2019, she went further and was made Boris Johnson's PPS. On her appointment, she said, "To serve the Prime Minister so closely in Parliament is a huge responsibility and an honour and one which I will take incredibly seriously." So to discuss that and more, my guest today is Trudy Harrison. So thank you very much for joining us today, Trudy. We really appreciate you finding the time. On this podcast, we like to begin by asking everyone the same question, which is, would you describe yours as a happy childhood?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. It was a very nurturing, loving childhood. I was very fortunate to be born into a kind family. And whilst my dad worked away from home most of the time, I think he was probably working at ICI Wilton when I was very young, and then out to the North Sea to work on the oil rigs, Mum stayed at home to look after me, and then my little brother arrived 7 years later. But I have very, very fond memories of going to my nana's farm, playing on the hay bales with my many cousins, enjoying tray-baked Yorkshire puddings made in the Arger, and visiting my other grandma who'd make crinkle-cut chips. It's all about food, this, isn't it, my childhood memories? But the other wonderful thing was the amount of wildlife that we managed to bring back to life. We were always going out on walks and finding birds and little animals to nurture and bring back to life. And that was a very fond memory I have of my childhood. Mainly, I think, because of my dad, who sadly isn't with us, but that is something that he has instilled in me and which I've instilled in my girls. I do actually remember when dad was on the oil rigs, blast from the past, kind of funny memory. I must have been about seven, actually. One of his jobs was working as the lifeboat driver, as well as an instrument mechanic, and he came across two cormorants that were covered in oil. So he brought them back into his bunk room, which he shared with two other guys, washed these birds down. I think they were called shags, actually. Washed them down, stored them alive and getting better in his shower cubicle, then brought them down over on the helicopter from Aberdeen to Seascale, and we nurtured them in our back garden and then eventually let them off on St. Bee's Cliffs. And I have got so many happy childhood memories of moments like that, of nurturing wildlife back to life.
So an animal-loving family early on.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. Dad could fix anything. And if he wasn't fixing machines, he was fixing nature.
Now, you've said that you've always been a conservative, you're brought up that way. Is that because it was a political upbringing you had, or something else?
No. And it was only when I became an MP that I learned that my grandma, on my dad's side, was actually a conservative campaigner. But I never knew this. You know, she was a woman with incredibly high standards. She'd lost her husband. My paternal granddad was a miner. He died before I was born. So she had an incredible social life. She lived on a council estate, Thornhill. Her garden was immaculate. And she would take me folk dancing and just had the best time with friends, even in her 90s. But I later learned that she was a Conservative campaigner, and I also learned that my granddad on my maternal side was a strong Conservative voter, but that was never discussed. You know, in 43 years, I think it was, when I, 41 I think I was, when I became an MP, that was never discussed at all. But I think all the values that I'd grown up with about working hard and personal responsibility, positivity, pragmatism, all that kind of thing was absolutely instilled in me. And I think those, the kind of ambition and determination and the ability to make what you want of your life, are very much part of the Conservative ethos, for me at least.
And how was school for you? Were you a well-behaved child or not so much?
It kind of got worse as I got older, to be honest. I was a very chatty girl. Primary school, absolutely fine. Certainly wasn't an academic flyer, and tended to daydream quite a bit, to be honest. I found myself going off into worlds which were far more exciting than the maths lesson. No, school actually wasn't that great. I left with no good GCSEs, thought I'd become a nanny, and had to take a kind of one-year fill-in course, which was a BTEC in hospitality at the local college. That then led to a job as a travel agent, which I really enjoyed. So my aims of becoming a nanny were effectively kiboshed because I was a travel agent, and then I later moved to Sellafield.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about moving to Sellafield, but I suppose first, did you have any early career? Well, you had the nanny ambition, I suppose, because you had some people, but you weren't thinking about politics when you were young.
Absolutely not. I didn't even know what politics was. No, I wanted to be a nanny, loved children, was very good with babies and children, and knew of nothing else, really.
Now, obviously, we're here because you now work in Westminster, but I wonder about your path in, because you go on to work at your local council and you also served as an independent parish councillor. And I was just wondering, can you talk us through how you went from that childcare business to starting to do those things?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we moved to the village, by which time I had most of our daughters, I certainly had Gabrielle, Savannah and Francesca. Rosemary was actually born in the little village of Bootle. I was quickly asked if I would like to join the local PTA, which I thought was a huge honour. Coming from a big town where you're a little fish, you soon realise that you can be quite a big fish in a small village because they're run by volunteers. And the social life is going to some kind of meeting every evening where we're planning on how we're going to raise money for an essential service in the village. That's how it ran. So I was really delighted to be asked the question. I became chair of the PTA, Parent Teacher Association. And then as my children were all getting to the age where they were all at school, I let the nursery go and joined the parish council, and I joined the school governors. And it was there that I learned that actually the school was really jeopardised. We'd lost 20 businesses in 20 years in our village. This school, Captain Shaw's, had been built in 1829 for 140 little learners, but the numbers had really dwindled. My daughter was the only one in her class, in her year, and it was bleak. I could not see a way of saving the school. The council had said it must close. It was also bleak on a national front. This was kind of 2007, so there was the, you know, financial crash. There were the headlines about how much debt our children and grandchildren would be burdened with. Knife crime was on the increase. The headlines nationally and the news locally felt dire. And I personally felt powerless at that time. I had a big fear of public speaking. I had no experience of community leadership, really, other than being part of these groups. But it wasn't real leadership. So anyway, I talk about women with balls. When I think back, it was crazy. I made a decision that there was no future for us in the Lake District, in the village of Bootle, or even in the UK. And I would pack up our transit Tornado. We bought a doer-upper to keep my husband out of mischief. So he set to work on that. I took the girls to the south of Spain, enrolled them in a Spanish state school. Nobody spoke any Spanish at the start, but by God, we didn't have to learn quick. And I think there would probably be then 4, 5, 8 and 9, something like that. And we lived there for an academic year, absolutely threw ourselves into the culture, discovered that the girls all played musical instruments, so they were welcomed into the local Academia de Musica. So they were welcomed into festivals, fiestas, carnivals, and I discovered my unique selling point was being a fairly confident driver with an 8-seater. And lots of the Spanish mums weren't confident about driving into the big city. So this was my thing. I made lots of friends by being useful. And we loved it. But what we learned is that in somewhere like Spain, you have very little voice. You really struggle to effect positive change in your community because the mayoralty and councils were pretty corrupt at that time. There were no community plans or councillor kind of opportunities. And I realised, speaking to quite a few expats, that the reasons they had moved to Spain to avoid knife crime and challenges with immigration, that kind of thing, were not the problems that I experienced in my little Lake District village. And I remember thinking, we've got to go back and fight. It makes me emotional now, honestly, it's ridiculous. So the following year, we made a decision to go back to Bootle, and I grew some balls, overcame my fear of public speaking, gathered a group of mainly mums together, formed a community plan team, and set about on an ambitious plan to breathe new life into Bootle for future generations, and got a job as a regeneration officer in the local council in 2010. And that was the start of my political journey, because not long after that, the comprehensive spending review was announced. And I remember the Labour leader of the council inviting us in. I was a member of staff, and it was just doom and gloom about what would happen to the council, what would happen to the area. And I just thought, it doesn't need to be like that. We can help, you know, people who've been made redundant find better jobs. We can do things differently. Then the big society, do you remember that? That came in. And it was something that really resonated with me, because the way villages work is around volunteerism. It's around collaborating with shops and business owners. And so this big society proposal was just me through and through. It's what I wanted to do. And I was able to kind of shape a role in the council where I would go out and help community groups achieve their priorities. I became experienced in funding applications and planning applications. I put myself through university one day a week at Salford to undertake a foundation degree in sustainable communities, which was really helpful, actually. And thoroughly enjoyed that job for 3 years until 2013, when I just realised that I wasn't going to make sufficient headway with the way that this council was running. And I was invited by private investors to work with them on socioeconomic projects which would be investing in my area. And that was the next step, really.
So you come back, you are now completely, you're focused, and it sounds like you're fired up at this.
I am, yeah, absolutely fired up. And in 2012, it was the 12th of April 2012, we were delighted to have the council overturn their decision to close Captain Shaw School. It had just 14 children in it at that point. I could finally take off my bear suit, because I worked for the local authority. When I was out campaigning, it wouldn't have been ideal for me to be identified, so I dressed up as Boo Bear and danced the streets, you know, protested on the A595. So finally I could remove my bear costume and celebrate that we'd managed to save the school. But we hadn't just done that. We'd come up with an ambitious plan to invest £20 million. We've got a new fire station, new housing development called Victory Gardens, new BMX track. The community just really came together, and we were able to pull in the funds, not just for our village, but for a raft of communities in the area. Now, when I was working for the private investors, I realised that we had the community plans. We had the local council on board. We'd managed to convince the Lake District National Park Planning Authority that they had either the key to our future or the death knell in the coffin. And thankfully, they chose to give us the key to our future. So very locally and more regionally, we were able to shape policies because of community planning, because of democracy, because of can-do people who know their area best, being positive and looking forward to effect change. But we were struggling nationally because I think where I live in West Cumbria, it takes me about 5 hours to get to work, to get to Westminster. So we never felt we would be anybody's political priority. And when the opportunity arose, when the Labour MP announced that he was standing down, I just thought, gosh, we really need to secure a nuclear power station because that will unlock so much of our future for West Cumbria. Who is going to put themselves forward? And I remember it was Boxing Night. It was still 2016, actually. So Jamie had just resigned a couple of weeks earlier, I think. I was in the pub. Half a bottle of Prosecco later, my friends managed to persuade me that I should stand as a candidate. And they were all thinking I would stand as an independent because, this was testament really to my lack of talking about politics with even the people nearest and dearest to me. But I came home that night, it would have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning probably, and I went through some of the party manifestos and listened to Theresa May talking and thought, that's me, that's who I am, that's what I want for my community, that's what I want for my country. And it was really a pivotal moment. And I spent the next week, given that this was Christmas and New Year, thinking about how I could possibly do this. No good GCSEs. I'd got my foundation degree. I had a severe dose of imposter syndrome, but a kind of similar high dose of determination.
Was your husband egging you on?
Not really, no. I remember telling my mum and dad, my mum said, Trudy, who said you could do that? And my dad said, nobody likes politicians, Trudy. They were both right.
But you go for it and you get selected as a candidate. Were you surprised to be selected for the candidate?
Not really, no, because given the state of my area at the time, and the things that needed to be done, I felt utterly confident that I was the perfect match. Female, grown up in the area all my life, family going back many generations, granddaughter of a miner and granddaughter of a farmer. My dad had worked at Sellafield. My husband at that point probably had about 38 years service as a nuclear welder. My brother worked in the nuclear industry. I didn't know then that my daughter would go on to work in the nuclear industry, but that was a really important, fundamental part of my campaign. Meanwhile, Jeremy Corbyn wanted to decommission all existing power stations and not build any new ones. That was absolute toxic in my community because we're incredibly proud and call ourselves the centre of nuclear excellence. So I was a Brexiteer, patriotic. I felt I was a perfect fit, and thankfully so did the Conservative Party at the time.
And you were here, you win that by-election. You've actually had to keep that seat in 3 votes now, you think, by-election, 2 elections since then, which is quite a lot for just a couple of years.
I think it probably is a record. I've tried to look into this. 3 elections in less than 3 years. The 2017 general election was absolutely horrid. I remember kind of 2 o'clock, 2:30 in the morning, waiting outside in McDonald's car park, about to go into the sports centre, thinking, if I've lost this, I am at peace with myself because I am not prepared to get into the gutter. It was absolutely toxic. The big issue at the time was the threat to maternity services. And I'd been born in this hospital. My 4 daughters were born in the hospital. I'd said that so many times. I was passionate about retaining maternity services at Westcumberland Hospital. But there were kind of fake handwritten letters going around. And on the front page of the newspaper, it said a vote for Trudy would kill 7 babies a year. I remember my dad reading that and it really affected him. It was horrible.
I was going to say, but I think perhaps you've answered it. I mean, it's clear when you thought about going to be the MP and particularly a Conservative MP, there was some hesitancy or, you know, protectiveness perhaps from your family about what that would mean for you. So have you been taken by surprise by how vitriolic it can be?
To some extent. I mean, if I could have made a bulk purchase of some kind of potion to give a thicker skin, don't get me wrong, I would. Of course you can't. Some of it doesn't really worry me at all. But that particular aspect, when it was something that I stood to do something about that and then was being attacked for trying to do something about that, it sickened me. And yeah, I think what it did to my dad in particular was awful.
Now, you're in Parliament. We talked about the 2017 general election, but I just wondered, as someone who's obviously so invested in your local area and really came up through local issues and local politics, what surprised you about Westminster or Parliament? Because there's some MPs who, they go down the special advisor route and therefore they're very used to the systems, whereas you're coming from quite a different perspective.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. And I think actually I've realised that the aspects of my life that I've maybe been embarrassed about, not having good GCSEs, having a northern accent, having a family young, I was pregnant at 21, absolutely planned, but all of those things I'd maybe felt previously held me back in life. Of course, the only thing holding me back was me. I know that now. But being in Westminster and mixing every day around the tea room table with people who are incredibly wealthy, incredibly successful, incredibly well educated, we're actually realising that the things that make us tick, the things that we want to talk about, are all the same. It's about our children, it's about what we want to achieve for our country, it's about where we want to go on holiday and experiences, it's about jokes. It's made me realise that regardless of how much money you've got or how educated you are or how well bred you might be, actually, we've all got this similarity as humankind.
So you have a few jobs quite early on as a PPS and you're sitting on the Education Committee. I think PPS is ultimately the lowest ring of the ladder when you're starting to do a bit more. And it's also known as glorified bag carrier.
Paper passing service was the description I was provided with, yes.
But one of the things I think with that job is often people say, well, that's how you get up, move on, that's how you get up. But it perhaps is a bit harder if you have a full family and things, because it's often working slightly on godly hours doing, as you say, passing paper and perhaps not the high-minded work that some people think they're going to come in and do. How did you find starting to do all that stuff? Did it work with having a big family at home? Was it stressful?
Yeah, I mean, my girls, through necessity, are very independent. I do sometimes think there's a fine line between kind of feral and independence. So by age 8, they were all able to operate the washing machine and make themselves their tea and breakfast. So they've been really independent girls. But to be honest, working in Westminster, it wouldn't really matter whether I was working a 6-hour day or a 16-hour day, because I am more than 300 miles away from home. So didn't really have an impact at all. But it's brilliant being a PPS. You just learn about the department in a way that is such a privilege. I've worked in the Ministry of Defence, the Department for Education, and that was absolutely fantastic insight, to be honest, to how the country runs essential services. I also worked across the Department for Transport as well. So no, it's far from being a paper passing service. It's actually a brilliant insight. You're able to find out things about your constituency that you might not otherwise do. Really enjoyed it. And to be the Prime Minister's PPS is obviously a huge privilege. I think there was one pivotal moment I remember when I found it really difficult. Our family dog died. I remember getting a text through, because I was in the chamber, from one of the girls who said, Harry's just collapsed, what should I do? Take him to the vets, of course, texted back. They got to the vets and they found that Harry had cancer and they put him down there and then. My husband was in a cell on the Sellafield site. He couldn't be contacted. I was just about to speak in the chamber and I couldn't leave. There was no, you know, remote opportunities back in those days. And thank goodness I could call on my mum and dad and they helped the girls get through, were able to bury the dog. That, you know, it's moments like that when I felt absolutely torn. But it's like what Kelly Clarkson says, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
A good motto for working in Westminster. Now, you mentioned that you're the Prime Minister's PPS. So he has two. One is Alex Burkhart. And you've kind of been billed as his PPS, probably his voice of the North, so to speak, when it comes to that group of MPs. So is that what's a day in the life as the Prime Minister's PPS like in that role?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, me and Alex are worlds apart. He is a doctor and PhD, educated. He's fantastic. He lives in the driest part of the UK. I live in the wettest part of the UK. We are worlds apart, but a great team. He's brilliant to work with. And in terms of our daily routine, it's mainly preparing the PM for PMQs. It's helping with any statements. We've had quite a busy weekend, it's been fair to say.
Yeah, we're recording this, just because we're going out straight, on the weekend after we've had a change of health secretary after Matt Hancock has left.
Yeah, so our job is essentially to feed in the concerns and suggestions from members of parliament directly to the Prime Minister. And I, as somebody who's worked and believes passionately in industry, naturally gravitate to concerns about the steel industry, energy industry, particularly the nuclear industry, and focus on that side of things, but also looking at how we can improve our relations around women in the population, the policies and its impact on women, and also our parliamentarians as well. So it's fantastic to be the Prime Minister's PPS. He is a wonderful boss to have. He is utterly inspirational. I wish more people could see the Boris Johnson that Alex and I see, actually, because what I see on a daily basis is the optimism, the enthusiasm, the determination and ambition for the country, and just an absolute kind of grip on what he wants to achieve, and urging everybody around him to have that same determination and ambition for our country.
Now, just one more thing on that. I just wondered, because you mentioned how you're doing, one of the things you're doing is trying to bring more women in and policy for women. So it'd be interesting to hear about that. But often Number 10 is written about as this blokey place. It's very macho. I think particularly when it was the Vote Leave team in there, it was a bit. And I just wondered, what's your experience of it? Is it macho? Is it getting less macho? Is it not?
It is a little bit on the macho side, but I think that's partly to do with just the nature of politics. The words that we use, well, I say we, I do not use words like annihilate, destroy. But I think that has been the kind of natural language of politicians for generations. So that's what we're contending with. But actually, I think other parts of society, women and a more caring way of doing things is showing that it's a better way of doing things. And that's a great change to see from my perspective.
Now, I've just got a few very quick final questions. So you mentioned energy. Obviously, we're talking about Cumbria, and there's been a lot about the Cumbria coal mine. We've also got COP26 coming up. Where do you think you sit on this? Because we're talking a lot about net zero, and I just wondered, is the Cumbrian coal mine compliant? Can that work? We don't know what's happening, but yet, can it work alongside something like a net zero target? Because there's been a bit of a debate in the Tory party on it.
Yeah, I mean, my take on this is one of pragmatism. If we agree that we're going to need steel, And at the moment, about 75% of the world's steel is made in blast furnaces, which need coking coal. Coking coal is one of the 27 essential raw materials that are, you know, reported on at the moment by the European Union. So if there's an agreement that we need steel, and just to put that into context, to build one of the Rolls-Royce 470 megawatt power stations, it will take 180,000 tons of steel. I just do not think it right that we can import that steel from, say, China, or that we can import that 2.177 million tons of coking coal, which is what we did in 2019, from places like Russia or Brazil or the United States, when we have a particularly high quality, high volatility coking coal, metallurgical coal, in the UK. And that's without talking about the £165 million of investment that it would bring, the 500 jobs, the 2,000 indirect jobs. When you think about how steel is used in wind turbines, in solar panels, in factories to build solar panels, in trains, in the tracks to build the routes for the trains, in electric vehicles, there is going to be an ever-increasing need for steel. And I think we need to be responsible and, as far as possible, have an indigenous supply for our steel industry.
And do you think your colleagues are hearing that?
Well, it's now had its politics taken out of it to some extent. We have a public inquiry on the 9th of September, which will run for 16 days. But it's difficult because the headlines are sensational. The words coal mine create an uncomfortable, unpalatable thought in many people's minds. And it really is only those people that take the time to understand the industry, understand the increase that's anticipated for the steel industry, and understand actually how steel is made. It's essentially an alloy. Without carbon, you've got iron, and iron is far too brittle to be building the things that we need to build today.
Now, final three quickfire. So the first is just, you mentioned you've had a busy weekend. Just while I have you, just have to ask, do you think Matt Hancock made the right decision to leave his role after what came out?
I spoke earlier about maternity services, and it was both Jeremy Hunt and Matt Hancock who have enabled about £140 million to be invested in the local hospital that I was born at, and we have, say maternity services. So I owe a huge deal of, you know, gratitude, and I will forever, to both Jeremy and Matt. That said, I think Matt himself realised that his position had become untenable. And it's sad, after all of his hard work and success, that it's ended this way. But as the final sentence in the Prime Minister's letter stated, he has a lot more to give to public service.
Now, final two, more light. How do you cope with stress? I think we might have had a hint when you were coming in, because you're one of the few guests to bring in, I think it's a gift.
not a bribe at all, Katie. It was definitely a bouquet that I popped out in my garden and picked. And as I look at it, we've got a fantastic array of various sweet peas. We've got a couple of different dahlias. We've got some chocolate cosmos, which smells divine. Ami Majus. Some pincushion flowers. Basically, I'm quite into gardening. I mean, I'm really into gardening. It is my new maternal instinct. I've nurtured my dahlia tubers since early March, and woe betide anybody that knocked them as they were trying to get past them, because they did take over my conservatory. Yeah, this is now my first love. It's blooming marvellous. It really is. And I'm not sure really what I'm going to do with it, because it has become an utter obsession. I deadhead, you know, whenever I can. Sunday morning, 7 o'clock, it's on with the wellies, out into the garden. And if I have my way, I won't come back until it's dark. It's just fantastic. And I don't think I'm the only one that looks forward to 9 o'clock BBC Two to watch Gardener's World. The problem is, because I've been out gardening, I end up falling asleep before Jobs for the Weekend comes on. I don't know whether you watch Gardener's World, Katie.
I don't have a garden, unfortunately.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Do you have a window box?
No.
You don't grow anything?
My fiance's got plants in the study, so he's got something. He's got one of those kind of electric growers that kind of can grow some herbs. But yeah, we don't have any outdoor. I'll work on it.
I started with houseplants, actually. That was my introduction. And monsteras, have you got those?
I'm not sure.
Oh, goodness me.
I've obviously got a lot of work to do.
This is a national trend. You really need to get with the programme.
It's a zeitgeist. So with that, while I go and work on my plant skills, the final question we're going to ask is when we ask everyone on this podcast, which is just, what's the worst advice you've ever been given? And we've had a mix of answers on this podcast. So we recently had Katy Perry on our last episode, who was saying it was that she should get elocution lessons, to which she said no. But I wondered, does anything strike you when you think back on your career and what we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I know I was definitely advised that taking the girls out of the school at that particular age would be really damaging to them, and I didn't take any notice of that. I've never really been one for advice, to be honest. I don't ask for advice. I don't even like cookery books because I feel like it's somebody telling me what to do. I really don't really appreciate it. But I do remember when I was putting myself forward as the candidate for MP for Copeland, I was advised to put a wedding ring on. You know, I'm married. I got married at Gretna Green on Christmas Eve 20-something years ago. But I've never worn a wedding ring. And I actually took the advice and bought one. Maybe it was serendipity. It was particularly cold during that January. And when I was leafleting in Cletemoor, at some point on an estate in Cletemoor, my wedding ring slipped off my finger and into somebody's house and never to be seen again, never wanted again.
Why did you choose Gretna Green? I'm going to sneak in a final question.
Well, to be honest, my husband wasn't really up for this marriage lark. And Gabrielle had been born. I was quite keen to have the same surname as her. So when my husband agreed that he would marry me on the 10th of December, I found the quickest place I possibly could, whisked him up there, and job done.
No room for changing of minds.
Pragmatist through and through. Solutions operated kind of girl.
Thank you so much, Trudy. That was brilliant.